Analytics Today, a podcast series that focuses on AI, data, and analytics and latest trends in the AI world. And I'm your co-host, Dr. Jeremy Roberts, and with me always is Sameer Khan. Hey, Sameer, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great, Jeremy. How are you?
Good, happy. So I'm here in San Antonio, Texas, obviously, and it is Fiesta. Happy Fiesta. This is
That's exciting. Time
of the year when the entire city of San Antonio shuts down to party for 10 days. And, you know, Rio has their stuff, you know, New Orleans has their parties. San Antonio, it's all about meats on sticks, right? And lots of roasted corn, like a lot of gluttonous activities, right? So you just go and eat and drink as much as you can. And today's a city holiday. Nobody's working. Nobody's going to school. Nobody's doing anything because there's a parade.
It's like official holiday, huh? I remember living in San Antonio and not having a holiday during Fiesta, yeah. So I missed that. Hey, Analytics Today listener, I want to tell you more about our newsletter, Solve with AI. And it's a free newsletter, and we publish a weekly content every Friday that is focused on practical, advanced generative AI techniques. To begin with, you're going to get access to a 7-day course, which is a crash course in generative AI. So in 7 days, you're going to learn 7 advanced AI techniques. And then each week, we're going to tackle a very specific challenge that you personally or professionally can face. Now, for example, we wrote content on how do you build advanced prompting techniques for boosting productivity. You can even leverage one of our newsletters to build your own virtual AI receptionist. And if you want to be really creative, there is a newsletter that we wrote on how to predict Bitcoin price using ChatGPT. With over 150,000 words of rich content, Solve with AI is going to be your go-to resource for staying ahead in the AI curve. And did I tell you that it's absolutely free for you to join? So go to solvewithai.substack.com. Again, it's solvewithai.substack.com, and you can register for the free newsletter and start improving your generative AI skill set, which is a highly demand skill set right now. The link is in the show notes if you want to get access to it. And if you have any issues, reply us back and let us know.
So cool. But you know what's really cool is today we have an absolutely fantastic guest on. His name is Carl Lovatis. Is that how you pronounce it correctly, Lovatis?
That's right. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. So let me quickly read your bio, and I'm going to shock the world with your brilliance, and then we're going to go into some questions. But researcher turned entrepreneur, Carl revels in leveraging data, algorithms, and machine learning to deliver compelling business value and drive company growth. He leads Sojourn's engineering and data science teams, focusing on using Sojourn's rich data sets to develop new products and improve online ad efficiency. And prior to that, he led the data science engineering team for Nanigan's RTB channels, building out their machine learning pipeline and real-time bid evaluation tier. At Inpowered, he built out Inpowered's content marketing platform, which empowered advertisers to discover, promote, and amplify positive organic content. And prior to that, he led Kayak's deals and email and online ad engineering, focusing on delivering and compelling the context-aware and personalized products. Carl transitioned to industry after earning his PhD in computer science from MIT and working on cybersecurity research at BBN Technologies and Intel Research. Oh my God, we have a rock star on here. And I think one of the things that's compelling is, me personally, I also have my doctorate, and I went gray. I did not have gray hair before I had my doctorate. After I finished it, I looked in the mirror and I realized my glasses prescription was worse. My back hurt. I was really good at typing, but I found the greatest tool, which is the most simplest tool on a Mac, which is advanced dictation. And I discovered that advanced dictation was the easiest way to write papers, because I would talk into my computer for 5 minutes and go back and edit it. And I realized I just wrote 5 pages, you know? And I just wanted to welcome you, Carl. Sameer and I are really excited to have you on the show today. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on. I've been looking forward to chatting. Yeah, it's been, as you read my bio, it's been a while. You know, I spent time all over, but it's been a fun ride, and I'm happy to talk about it and share any any of my experiences. Regarding dictation, I had my bout with dictation. You know, a lot of typing in grad school and undergrad, and you know, if you don't use the right posture, you get RSI and stuff like that. So I've had my challenges with that, but I've worked through them. So you know, dictation was like a savior at some point.
I'm sure. And so I think what we'll do today is we're going to go through a series of questions. Some of them will be work related. Some of them will just be about your journey, kind of just how you got here. You know, and just to give you an idea, and this is something we want to tell you as a guest, but we also tell our new guests, people that are joining us for the first time, we have a whole variety of people. I mean, I think, Samir, if you could give me an idea, what are the different groups of people that we have on? So when Carl speaks, he knows exactly who we're talking to here. Like, who do we have?
So our audience is across the spectrum, right? So we have executive level people on one end, and then we also have kind of the middle management, which also includes business owners that are entrepreneurs and small business owners. And then on the right side of the spectrum, we have analysts, specific managerial functions within either technology space or specific data spaces, like analytical manager, analytical engineer, or database engineer, database manager. So it's all around the place. So we have a wide variety of audiences, just so that we make sure, like, you know, your answers touch across the board. But we want to make sure that the conversation is casual, and although we want to touch on specific professional areas, we want to make it very engaging. So don't feel pressured to answer the exact question. You can go into tangent, and we can talk about many different areas. So you don't necessarily have to like stick to a particular format.
And if you want to keep it as engaging as possible. But if you want to nerd out on AI, I think Samir would love to just go head to head with you and just think how nerdy can we get? You know, how nerdy can we get?
But you know, let's see. He has multiple PhDs from MIT. I don't think I can stand a chance.
Well, let me start with a question about your journey. So let's talk about that, and then we'll move into other stuff. But, you know, first, Carl, could you share kind of your background, your MIT background, particularly in fields like computer science, aero, astro, and really to the point where I want to talk about how that has shaped your approach to technology and leadership in the tech industry, because I'll give you a premise behind it. I'll come back to the question. There's a lot of different people who end up in tech. There's a lot of different people who end up in AI, in this new tech world, right? And they come from a vast different, you know, group of backgrounds. I know people that do English lit, right? They go to like Ivy League schools and do English lit, and they end up in technology. And you're sitting there thinking, why did you do that? There are people that go into random things and they end up here. Let's talk about your journey and how you started in school and then how you ended up here.
I was always interested in technology from high school. I started taking some programming classes in high school, and I really enjoyed them. One of the things that I really liked is that you could, within hours or days, you know, you could build something that actually delivers some value or has some purpose and executes against that purpose. And so the time to completion or time to value is really quick, with software. So I was really intrigued by that. But I was also intrigued with kind of space. I was growing up in the 80s. You know, there was the shuttles and all that. And I really felt that the aeronautics and was kind of at the cutting edge of technology. So I was eager to explore that. So I found myself at MIT, and I followed both paths there. I double majored in aero-astro and computer science, which was, in hindsight, it was rewarding, but also very challenging. So, you know, you look back and you say, hey, was it worth it? Or would I have done something different there? But anyway, I did it, and I enjoyed both areas. And as I was progressing through my studies, I found that back then, you know, in the 90s, the time to get something out the door on the aero-astro side was years, or you know, you have to develop it, you have to test it, you have to make sure it's
space and costly.
costly. You're right. Yeah. Now things have changed, you know, with the era, you know, space kind of projects being much more commercial rather than research or government funded. But back then it was tough. And whereas on the software side, the cycle of developing and executing and delivering values was really quick comparatively. Yeah. So I enjoyed that. I definitely felt that I would become an academic as I was going through my studies. But as I was doing that, as I was going through my grad studies, I felt that the research cycle was and research after that. I joined a couple of research labs, and although the work was very interesting, very had a cutting edge, even there the cycles of research and were longer, and also you work on something and many times, that's not always the case, but many times it takes long for that work to be adopted, or it's not really adopted, it doesn't generate value in the commercial industry sector. So I felt that for me, the right path at that point was to switch from research to industry.
I like it.
And find a job that kind of bridges that gap. It was much more on the applied science kind of side in industry, but was definitely a position that allowed me to really iterate quickly and deliver value.
Yeah,
I like that. So let me ask a part two. Actually, if you don't mind, let me ask a part two, and then Samir can get
into
part.
No, I was very curious about it, the Aero Astro experience, because you know my daughter is planning to go into that space. So I was going to probably table one of my personal questions at the end. So that's good. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so let me ask this one, and then Samir, you actually go into that too. But I'm curious, did you have a mentor, or did you have some type of bad or good manager? So we always talk about this in every podcast. When we interview somebody, they either have a mentor, somebody that kind of held their hand and said, "Hey, Carl, here's your path. You know, you're not doing this, or you should be doing this," or you had somebody who was a leader or a manager that you had that was really good or really bad. And sometimes some people has like the absolute manager from hell, and that manager from hell actually changed their entire career, and now they're on this great path. So what happened to you? I mean, was there something?
I more so had mentors than managers from hell, which is fortunate. Although you can learn from bad experiences, of course, right?
Yeah.
But the nice thing about my grad studies, my PhD advisor, Professor Nancy Lynch, she was in distributed systems. She was really well known. She is really well known in the field of distributed systems. But the nice thing about her is that she also realized that her students have their own interests and paths. And so, although you may assume that she would be, as a professor, they would be, she would be pushing for an academic path for her students, for all of them. That was definitely not the case. She was, you need to choose your path, whatever you enjoy working on, we can fit it into our group, there are limits, of course, but she was very open to exploring new areas her students were interested in, and then really supporting them in their paths. And I that's something that stuck with me afterwards, because in the industry, of course, you have constraints, you need to deliver products, then you need to cater to the individuals of your team and to the degree that you can. And really figure out a path that will keep them engaged such that you can retain them. And so I think that was a good lesson. My advisor was really a mentor in that way, that not only was she a mentor from a technical perspective, but from a follow your own path perspective.
Nice.
That's great. So I'm going to have a two-part question. Like, I'm trying to think in terms of how do I frame it. So from a career standpoint, when I'm looking at your career, right? So you started your journey in cybersecurity research in some of the companies like, you have in your bio, like Intel and BBN Technology. And then eventually you transitioned from a research-focused role into more an entrepreneurship and leadership across various tech organizations, and you know, though your most recent role as a CTO of Sojourn. So how these different experiences influence your perspective on multiple areas, like in data security and integration, and also your mindset, like, you know, shifting the mindset from doing a hardcore PhD level research to going into entrepreneurial area, which is all about revenue, all about numbers and financial data. Like, how did you do that transition?
First, you know, whenever I looked for a position, I really focused on companies that were focused on leveraging data and algorithms and machine learning. So I was keeping my focus on what I enjoy doing as well, such that I can also be successful and deliver value to those businesses. So I was selective in what type of positions I was embarking on. And so, I mean, I was fortunate enough, a very good friend of mine had joined as the chief scientist at Kayak. Mm. And he was, this is Yorgos Zakharia. Now he's the president. He became the CPO and the president. And he really was talking to me about the value that data science and algorithms can bring to Kayak. And so he really felt that it was a great landing spot for transitioning from academia, let's say, or research to industry. And in fact, that was the case. So I joined a very dynamic tech company that valued algorithms and data and machine learning, and really pushed to improve revenue by better monetization of the various products that they were working on their side. So highly dynamic environment. Their then CTO, Paul English, is an amazing technologist. He's definitely an entrepreneur at heart, but also a technologist. So he can really figure out the path, the products that need to be built that drive value for customers. And so he was at the helm there from a technology perspective and product perspective, and he really drove that forward aggressively. And one of the great things about Paul and people like that is that they bring everyone up with them, right? They really energize everyone that's around them to really deliver value for customers. And so so that helped me realize that although I may not be getting to the 100% solution or refinement of a solution that you might get in academia, because you keep on working on the same thing until you get it to the 100% or 99%. In industry, what you do is you get to the 80% that delivers value, and then you move to the next thing that will deliver 80%. And if you get enough of those 80%, let's say, you really can grow the company, of course, but definitely deliver that value to the customers. So it's a little shift of frame of mind, of identifying that the success is not getting the best solution that you can possibly have and spending months, quarters, years on it, but delivering the most value that you can to your customers. And if you can make that shift, it's not that hard. And if you work in companies where data and algorithms are at the core, it's not a very big step to make. Mm-hmm. So I was fortunate enough to keep on following, joining companies where data and algorithms are at the core.
Yeah, I like that, because I've come across a few individuals that I work in my professional career as well, where they started in academia, and you know, in some cases they may struggle to go into a more corporation where it's high intensity, high demand, revenue focus, street focus, all of those. I like what you articulated here. It's like, in terms of identifying the fundamental value that you're trying to drive, because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if it's an academia or entrepreneurial journey, it's about the value you're creating, right? You may create the value for the institution that you're working in from an academic perspective, and then from a business perspective, the value that you're generating for your end customers, shareholders, and including internal employee as well. So I like the way you approach and focusing on that notion of value, which a lot of people tend to forget. Like, you know, they get into the weeds of like, hey, I'm doing research, I'm doing this advanced stuff, and now I got to go please these bunch of people in Wall Street. How will that work? And so I think the value creation was the thing that I latched out to.
Yeah, and if I may say one more thing here. One of the great things that I've learned throughout my different companies is that in order for you to recognize that value, you have to go, and since we're on an analytics and kind of a blog here, podcast, measuring the value that you're delivering is critical, because it's very easy to go to my engineering team and say, well, the work you did last month generated this value. This is the dashboard. Go look at it. You know, you improved our revenue by 2% this month, right? And just having that measurement and having engineers look at the measurement and really see what the value that they're delivering, or the applied scientists or whatnot, is critical. And that's another thing that Paul English and Kayak did from the beginning really, really well. They had an A/B testing infrastructure. You could actually run A/B tests, compare performance of your new feature with respect to status quo, and see the delta that you generate in terms of revenue. Mm-hmm. So it was really tangible. The value that we generated for the business was really tangible. And we have continued that throughout.
Yeah, that's actually a very good segue to one of the things that Jeremy is going to lead into.
And I'll say something before that. I actually, I taught in academia for 5 years, and I saw myself as a very different type of professor than all the other people that went straight from undergrad into master's into PhD and then went straight into academia, maybe consulted in the real world. But obviously for us that have been in the real world for so long, 20 plus years, we don't see it the same. And I'm not busting anybody's butts here. I'm sorry if I'm offending anybody, but it's not the same. And so when you go and you listen in on a class who somebody has pure academia background, you know, they're very by the book. They talk about a little bit of philosophy, you know, a little bit of, you know, practical application, and they talk about theoretical application. But when you listen to my class, I give you a real world example for every single thing that we talk about, and then it translates. And then all you do is just do a quick like Q&A afterwards and say, which class did you learn more from, theirs or mine? And I always won. And so because they're like, I remember it because it was a real world application. Right. So you know what I mean? It was one of those things. Sure. So had to say that. Okay, so really excited today because, you know, as a CTO of Sojourn, you're at the forefront of advancing online advertising efficiency, right? This is your bread and butter. So can you discuss any kind of recent innovations that your team has developed and something that you find really exciting with advertising or something you've done with online efficiencies?
Sure. So one of the things that we, you know, has been the holy grail of online advertising for forever is basically helping clients optimally spend their marketing budget across various online channels of advertising, right? So historically, you know, especially large corporations, you know, the marketing budgets have been very segmented. You know, I have my display advertising budget that we budget in the beginning of the year. I have my social, I have SEM. It's very segmented. That's for large clients, of course, because they have a large budgets, many teams. But for smaller players, you know, they might have one marketing team that is responsible for everything. And what we've been building at Sojourn is basically a cross-channel optimization marketing engine, if you will. So the intent there is to be able to specify one budget, one goal, you can do multiple goals. But the intent is have one budget for a particular goal and then optimally spend that budget across all channels. So we've integrated with several display DSPs, which includes video, also social, search engine marketing, and meta search inventory. Meta search is less commonly known in general, but it's specific to travel. It's basically advertising inventory on various meta search engines, let's say Kayak or Trivago or things like that. Google Hotel Ads. And so you can place advertisements on their websites and buy that inventory. So that's called meta search. And so the intent there, and so we're building and we're refining our platform where you can optimally spend your budget across all these channels. And of course, where you spend the budget might depend on what tactics you're trying to, you know, whether it's retargeting or whatnot.
Let me ask a question about that. So is this kind of like an automated, intelligent form of marketing mix modeling? I mean, in my mind, because if you break it down, the true act of marketing mix modeling is you're sitting there thinking, and this happens, God, I cannot stand this in the corporate world. Every quarter after Q1, what happens? Happens to everybody. They cut your budget, right?
Right.
After Q1, everybody in the corporate world, if you've been in the corporate world, you get all this money to spend in November, December, and you sign all these contracts. And at the end of Q1, what happens? Hey, we're sorry. It's April, May. You know, the street's not really excited about this. So we need to cut your budget. And you're sitting there freaking out. And then all of a sudden, you have to go through your marketing mix modeling exercise. And I think, Carl, exactly what you're talking about is exactly that. Because what do they ask you? Give me a list of all your channels. Tell me which one is working. Tell me which one is not working. And then the first thing you sit there and say, okay, I cannot tell you a single channel that's not working because we don't work like that.
It's interconnected.
Everything has a little bit of attribution. Everything is interconnected. Maybe we can change the levels of one into the other, but I love you use this phrase, use the phrase, I think it was exactly something along the lines of like your spend across all, right?
Right.
You put in the money and the spend is dispersed across all, but there's a game with it, right? You have to keep on testing those. This is the brilliant part. And I think what we can learn today, if you're listening to this today, what you got to learn is if somebody tells you, cut your budget or cut this, please, for the love of God, do not cut a whole channel. Do not just cut something because your manager told you.
Fight with data.
Fight with data. Come back and say, we'll do a 10% decrease. Yeah, Carl, could you elaborate on that? Because it like blows my mind.
When we set up campaigns for our clients, you know, they have multiple, you know, there's a prospecting tactic, there's retargeting, and so on. And so they could have various line items, so to speak. I don't know if that's resonated,
sure.
But line items for each of the channels. And so we're doing cross-channel optimization across the line items, not across the channels. So it's one level deeper, so to speak. So you don't want to starve a whole channel necessarily because some pockets of that channel may still be working for you. So you want to keep spending there or increase your spend there. So the optimization happens at a lower level than the channel, but you can definitely adjust budgets. And the tricky thing about online advertising is that you can't increase your budget on a particular tactic that's working infinitely because the inventory might not be there, right? So there's a point of diminishing return,
exactly, right?
There's a point of diminishing return, right?
Yeah.
So it's interesting. The analogy I have is portfolio management. You know, you have $10,000 and you want to invest them. You invest them across many stocks, let's say, and then depending on their performance, you might start selling some and buying others, right? And so that's
options, right? You don't want to invest the entire money in specific stocks, so you can go and figure out how do I leverage options. So I think that's great. Actually,
options,
I was going to ask you a specific question about that. I know that, you know, the buzzword around machine learning, although machine learning has been there for like almost 50 years now, but people are still very excited about it with AI and Gen AI capabilities. So let's say if you have that type of a problem, the attribution problem and marketing mix problem that you have, and there's a corporation that want to leverage more data. So how do you, at Sojourn, how do you go into identifying those complex problems and then tackle them with machine learning or AI today?
Sure. So, I mean, we instrument everything to collect all the data that we need, all the performance data, and we track performance of each of these line items, so to speak. And then we build, based on historical data that we have, we build machine learning models to predict particular things about those line items. For example, we may predict what the conversion rate is of that particular line item. We might predict what the available inventory is for that line item. So we know what capacity we have, how much we can grow. We know what the performance might be. And so we use these machine learning models to predict what our expected performance might be from a particular line item. So then you can basically say, hey, is it worth investing more there or not? Or you kind of invest in the highest ROI, if you will, line item, and you starve the least ROI line item. That's in very general terms. And then we use OR techniques for optimization, operation research techniques for optimization across line items. And then we use machine learning to predict the various metrics for each line item, for example, as I mentioned, for example, conversion rate or inventory, things like that.
So, Carl, when we talk about this advertising, and a lot of times, you know, you want to be a little bit more aggressive. Sometimes you want to say, you know what, I want to push a little bit harder. I want to push the boundaries of my limits. Is that some type of technology or something that you've implemented into your programs with your machine learning?
Yes. With all of these techniques, your machine learning, is only aware of the data you collected in the past. So in order for machine learning to learn more, you need to explore beyond what you've seen in the past. So aggression, you're walking that exploit line or exploration. You're exploring new boundaries of your data set, if you will. Exploitation is you've learned it and now you're trying to make money off of it, right? Or you're trying to exploit it, basically. So we have instrumented all our systems to explore various line items and various budgets and bidding for particular line items, such that we can learn and see, and then machine learning takes that data into account. And then
if you're bidding on CPMs, sometimes if you're bidding on CPMs and you're bidding on position sometimes, and you're bidding on like share of voice and all these different things, you know, I think a lot of people don't realize this. There is a theoretical aspect to advertising to where you could dominate. If you go in there and you control them, it's like controlling the stock market, right? Controlling the stock. If you go in and you control the price, the CPM, and the share of voice that's out there and the amount that you're pushing, you can control the advertising, right? You can blow everybody out of the water. What I mean? If you're willing to pay a little bit more, those people that their upper and lower control limits on their thresholds max out at a certain CPM, you could temporarily, it's like what the big grocery stores here in San Antonio, when another grocery store comes in, they raise their prices or lower their prices, and everybody gets out of the
winner
market.
Winner gets all, right? It's the same fundamental. So, exactly.
Winner gets all. So advertising, you can go in there and slightly adjust your CPMs, your costs, and your inventory, and just blow out the small competitors, and then level it back down. You never have competition.
Right. Yeah, and so
I love it.
Yeah, go ahead, Carl.
The nice thing. Yeah, one of the nice thing about this, the tug of war between exploration and exploitation is that you always have to explore, but then once you explore, you can exploit, and then what you do is you use your exploits to explore even further, right? So if you're at a good spot in terms of performance, you can leverage what you're making in order to put that back into exploration. In a more research sector, it's like making money off of a cash cow, let's say, and then funding your research, right?
Yeah.
So that's
Note, like one quick topic, I just want to peel it a little bit on the exploration side, right? So from the technology that you have built at Sojourn, is there option to go in with a specific hypothesis on like, hey, I believe that this is what it should be, going in with a certain assumption and certain hypothesis, or it's pretty much just relying on the technology to tell you what's out there without necessarily having certain hypothesis about it? Well, yeah, it like could be goal setting or like, you know, I believe like my, let's say my display media on Mashable.com is performing better than the display on Facebook, right? That's my hypothesis. And but then I will go in with that assumption and provide inputs to my model, and the model could come back and say, no, you're wrong, because it is not performing better. Your Facebook advertising is performing much better than Mashable.com. I'm just making it up. That's an example. I don't know if that's a capability.
It's a mix. Oftentimes, we run, in addition to building the algorithms, we also run A/B tests where we have a hypothesis of something.
Okay, so you can do that A/B test. Okay, got it.
Like that, and then we run a particular test. So we have a hypothesis, we execute on the test, and then we can measure whether our hypothesis was true or not. On the exploration exploitation, we have built capabilities to explore. If you think of it as we're working on how best to explore. So it's an algorithm to explore. So we've built that algorithm, and then the algorithm will learn, will allow us to collect data that will allow us to learn what works better and not. And then machine learning picks that up and leverages that learning. So it's less of we have a hypothesis. There is this, that we've built the capability to explore. And then by exploring, you get more data, and then you can leverage that data in order to understand what's happening. So it's less of having a hypothesis, more like let's explore, collect data, and then leverage that data to do better.
Very good. I know we have a couple of questions with the implication. Jeremy, you want to go ahead and talk about a little bit on the privacy side, because I know that's an interesting topic to a lot of people.
So when you're talking about the way that technologies have evolved, there's always this concern about privacy, right? Where do you see the future of online advertising headed, you know, with the roles of privacy coming into play? I know this has been, for me, I used to work at Adobe, and, you know, it's one of those things to where it's like, I remember we panicked for a few days saying, oh my gosh, we're not going to be able to, you know, our privacy problems are going to, we're going to have all these privacy problems. We're not going to be able to see our cookies, you know, first party cookies, all these different things. Like when you get into privacy, what are these big concerns that you're having? And then does AI and machine learning have a role in shaping that future?
In the online marketing, in ad tech, you know, there's a tug of war, if you will, between privacy and performance, right? And so the whole ecosystem is evolving over time to ensure, predominantly to ensure that consumers are at least aware of if and how they're being tracked, and have a say in if they're okay with being tracked or not, right? So, there's been evolutions of how this happens in the ecosystem. And so, I think there's going to be a continuous evolution there where we're building more and more capabilities for consumers to be able to have control over how much tracking they're willing to, they're okay with. And then the marketers will live within those bounds. So, you know, things are changing, and there's, there's a lot of focus on privacy nowadays, of course, which is great. So the whole ecosystem will evolve, and every ad tech company there is evolving with it. So in the future, there'll be more controls of consumers. People will either consent or not consent to being tracked, or whatnot. The thing that the ecosystem, the ad tech ecosystem, needs to do, in my mind, is to demonstrate the value that consumers get by being tracked, right? So it's an exchange, it's a value.
It's a trade-off.
It's a trade-off.
It's like, I'm willing to give you my information, but you got to give me something back.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I think the technology world sometimes just like freaks out. You know?
Yeah. So I think that we need to do better at communicating the value that tracking and gives you, and that's not only on the marketing side; it's also on the product side. tracking what I've done on a particular website and improving my experience the next time around or whatnot, or allowing Google to sift through my email such that they can remove
it's the tug of war of innovation and technology,
corporate responsibility, you know what I mean? Right, because I feel like and you know, you and I have been living in this space, Jeremy, for like a long time, and likewise you as Carl, like, you know, growing into this from a research perspective and now it's from an entrepreneurial leadership standpoint. I feel like the corporate responsibility, I don't know what you feel about that. My personal opinion is, Carl, like, some companies have become like an 800-pound gorilla, and they now use your data the way they like it, and they kind of, sometimes it's misused, right? I don't want to call specific companies or anything like that, but I do see a lot of times when on you're watching a specific video and then you see this ad pop up, the ad is not legitimate, looks like a complete spam, but the company is making money out of it from that ad that's running on their network because it's driving a lot of views. So how do you feel about the corporate responsibility notion when it comes to privacy, and what are the recommendations as a CTO?
Yeah, so I mean, we focus a lot of time on abiding by and integrating with the various solutions for preserving privacy and ensuring we're abiding by the desires of consumers. So a lot of our time is spent on that, and it is important for every company to do that. And I think in general the ecosystem is trying to do that, but of course they're trying to balance revenue and things like that. So that's tricky. But we are, the whole ecosystem is working on solutions to be more privacy preserving, and so I think we're evolving in the right direction. And to answer Jeremy's second question, which was more on, is machine learning and AI going to help with that? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of motion now to move away from one-to-one tracking and start using machine learning to track and attribute value, conversions or value to various, marketing campaigns based on aggregate, machine learning models versus direct attribution, if you will. So which adds a level of indirection that is somewhat privacy preserving, right? So or ensures that the privacy is preserved. So I think there's a lot of good motion in that area, but with change comes worries, right, in the ecosystem. So now that we're evolve and that Google is trying to deprecate third-party cookies on Chrome, there's a big, a lot of the ecosystem is evolving and will evolve for the better, but the transition will be a little tricky. So everyone's trying to mitigate its impact.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I think that was great. Switching gears a little bit, I know we're coming to a close of our podcast. I do have one very important question that I would like to leave our listeners with. Is what advice would you give young professionals who aspire to become a C-level technology executive in the tech space or highly competitive industry? What would you tell them today, given like this whole AI coming in and the notion of taking away the jobs and lots of competition? What would you tell them today, which is very different than where you and I when we were trying to find our first job, right?
Well, I think, and Carl, think of it as like somebody who's already jumping in their career. They've been in their career for a little bit, but they have that aspiration to get
there. Yeah, that's a good concept.
So that's their end goal, is to get where you're at. But right now they've been in it for a few years out of college already.
Right. One thing that is critical is to follow one's passion. So if you're passionate about something, that will help you stick with it, put more effort into it and so on. And just follow your passion and don't relinquish your passion for a higher paying job or something, something. You have to stick to your passions because that's where you'll excel. The other thing is that we work within companies, we work within teams. So you need to find a spot where you're you can work well with a team. You're each of the team members is elevating every others. You have a good manager that is promoting you, that is giving you more responsibility, you know, holding you accountable, because that's how you can really demonstrate your value and growing. And so, and as you grow and you become manager and director and so on and so forth, you need to, although you think that it's counterintuitive, right? By growing your team and focusing on your team to grow, you're basically helping yourself, right? So if you focus on your team and build them up and focus on their growth, inadvertently you're helping yourself grow as well. And that's something that's important.
That's fantastic.
You know, it's funny. That's the commonality that I've seen with all great CTOs. All the CTOs that Samir and I have respected and have worked with, the ones that we see that are great at their job, all have teams that love working with them. And when they get promoted, everybody underneath them gets elevated and everything around them gets elevated. And it, just as you said, when they move, they take their team with them. They take their people with them. Yeah. And they like to have their crew with them. You know, so I love it. This has been fantastic. Yeah, go for it, please.
Maybe one more thing. As I've grown and I've, now being CTO, you know, when I first joined Sojourn, you know, I worked with my team to really figure out, look ahead, you know, to think of the company 2 years ahead of where we were in terms of the org structure and kind of who we need to bring in to really round up the team and making sure we have the right expertise. And so it took some time, but it basically that thought process of what would we want the team to look like and who do we need to bring on board. And so you know, that's also critical as well. You need to be strategic in how you're building out your teams and find the right people that would elevate your team. So that's also critical as well. And I've been fortunate enough at Sojourn. I've been really fortunate enough to bring really fantastic folks on my team that are really driving value.
Awesome.
For
it's been great.
This is great. And thank you again. You know, for coming on the podcast has been great. And, you know, it's one of those things to where Samir and I have this privilege of meeting all these amazing people. And, you know, we want to thank you again for coming on. We always ask, let's say 6 months down the road or 1 year down the road, you have something new and innovative you want to bring back. Let us know. Come back on the show and we'll be like, you know what, let's nerd out even more. And Samir and I will be ready with some stunner questions, something to really like blow people's minds. But
sounds good.
Also, if you have some friends that you'd like to have us interview also, please let us know.